In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On this Politics Wednesday, we're joined by Karen Kodrowski, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. Karen, welcome back to the program.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be here. Thanks, Ben.
Also with us, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, where he's professor of political science. Dennis, after a bit of an absence, glad to have you back.
I'm glad to be here. Hi, all.
Hi. Well, during this hour, we want to invite our listeners also to join us on any of the half dozen or so topics that we'll be surveying this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Later in the hour, the dueling messages about the latest economic stimulus package. We'll also discuss the migrant surge at the southern border. We're hearing in our news there's testimony on Capitol Hill at this very moment to do with that. Also, we'll talk about the filibuster. President Biden endorsed filibuster rule changes, not getting rid of it, but rule changes last night in an interview. Also, some Iowa politics, a bill advancing in the Iowa legislature to ban diversity training that is divisive. Devices in terms of racist or sexist. We'll hopefully have time to get that in. Breaking news within the last few minutes, our governor, Kim Reynolds, says all Iowans will be eligible for COVID-19 vaccinations starting April 5th. Now, that's assuming that the supply increases as expected, okay? That's the caveat there, the breaking news. Within the last few minutes, Kim Reynolds announcing all Iowans eligible for the COVID-19 vaccination starting April 5th, assuming, and we all hope, that the supply increases. Let's start in with the politics of this vaccination campaign and the political challenges of reaching herd immunity, how to handle opposition to vaccination for the coronavirus among a number of groups. We've heard African Americans have some opposition based on historical experience there. Also, there are the anti-vaccine activists. Well, now polling indicates that opinions are breaking substantially along partisan lines. A third of Republicans said in a CBS News poll they would not be vaccinated, compared to 10% of Democrats. Another 20% of Republicans said, we're unsure. And other polls have found similar trends. Let's go to hear our former president in an interview on Fox News last night. The former president, Trump, spoke about his administration's response to the coronavirus pandemic, how the development of the vaccine can be credited to him. He was also asked if he recommended people to take the vaccine.
I would recommend it, and I would recommend it to a lot of people that don't want to get it, and a lot of those people voted for me, frankly. But, you know, again, we have our freedoms, and we have to live by that, and I agree with that also. But it's a great vaccine, it's a safe vaccine, and it's something that works. And we've been working round the clock, and what I got the FDA to do, this would have happened in many, many years from now if I didn't get involved and if we didn't get involved.
Okay, former President Trump yesterday on Fox News, it's worth noting that Donald Trump and his wife, the former First Lady, were vaccinated in secret in January. Dennis Goldford, explain what you see here in this divide indicated by the polls and the significance of the president coming out to encourage, I suppose, especially his voices, his supporters.
There's, of course, a certain core element of people who are mistrustful of vaccines generally. We've got all these issues of so-called anti-vaxxers. So that's part of a lot of this. It's been politicized to a great extent. It was, frankly, from the Trump administration originally. Remember when people talked about it, former President Trump said that, well, you know, he didn't think he would get it. Of course, as you noted, he did get it, according to reports, he and his wife last December. But it's been politicized, unfortunately. And to a great extent, people are portraying this or understanding this in terms of the idea of individual freedom. And if I understand the science of this, though, and I'm not a medical person at all, it's not like your choice as to what color shirt to wear on any particular day. You know, we would all dislike the government telling us we could or couldn't wear a certain color shirt. That seems to be a matter pretty much of individual freedom. But again, given my understanding of the science of this, the issue of the vaccine is that it protects you, the person who gets it, to some extent, but it protects other people more significantly from being vulnerable to the possibility of your spreading it itself. So again, people want to say, well, it's my personal decision. Mm-hmm. By that logic, we should get rid of traffic regulations. It's my personal decision as to whether I want to stop at a particular intersection or what speed to go. Most people say, no, this is to make sure that other people don't get hurt. And those advocating the vaccination, I think, take it from that point of view. Yes, there's some diminution of individual freedom, but it's for the purpose of ensuring that other people don't get hurt, as it were, by the possibility of your spreading the vaccine. Just the final point is that, you know, there's an old expression, which is that my freedom to extend my fist ends where your chin begins. And that's what I think a lot of this is about.
Karen, your thoughts on this?
Well, I've been reflecting on this, and my first thought was, when was the, you know, when have we ever politicized a disease before? And then I realized that, in fact, we have. You can think back to the AIDS epidemic when it was raging in the 1980s. That was highly politicized in terms of, you know, a controversy about who who was at highest risk of contracting the disease, whether or not government agencies were indifferent to the magnitude of the disease, condemnations of lifestyles of the people who contracted the disease. And I also think that, you know, like smoking and lung cancer, a lot of people talk about, you know, who have lung cancer will say that they feel as though that they're blamed, and because, you know, they were smokers or had other habits that might have, you know, led to them to develop lung cancer, and that therefore then there's not quite the same investment in treatment options because there's this notion that you brought this on yourself. I think part of this version of vaccine hesitancy is not just the anti-vaxxers who I think are skeptical of vaccines or skeptical of what they call big pharma, but also that there is this pervasive belief among some Trump supporters that this disease is not very serious, that it's just like getting the flu, you know, or a minor cold. And so therefore, why would you need a vaccine for something that's not that serious to begin with? Of course, this flies in the face of the fact that 500,000 people have died and that life expectancy actually declined last year as a result of this disease, which is in fact very serious.
And it's worth noting here, you know, to the point of whether the former president can convince, you know, the significant number of Republicans to get vaccinated so that we may all benefit from herd immunity, so that the variants are nipped in the bud. The more this disease is transmitted, the more opportunity it has to produce mutations. Variants. That's another danger as well. Interestingly, the current president, Joe Biden, said at the White House on Monday, "I discussed it with my team, and they say the thing that has more impact than anything Trump would say to the MAGA folks is that the local doctor is what the local doctor, what the local preachers, and what the local people in the community say. So that's an interesting observation by the current president. Let's turn to the economic side of this pandemic, which we've been dealing with since the very start of the health crisis of this pandemic. 1 week ago today, the stimulus law known as the American Rescue Plan passed the Democratic-led U.S. Congress despite unified Republican opposition. Now, it's worth noting Republicans supported pandemic-related relief bills under Trump, but have rejected Biden's plan, saying too expensive, not sufficiently focused on the public health crisis, according to Republicans. Now, there has been a big push here by the White House to promote this. Help is Here is the tour that includes the president, the vice president, Kamala Harris, First Lady Jill Biden, and others. Later this week, they're to visit Georgia. I think the stops yesterday included Pennsylvania, two states that were interesting, or that will be also interesting in control, retaining control of the Senate. Karen, let me start with you. How do you see these dueling narratives over the latest stimulus package playing out with an eye on 2022?
That's a great question. You know, first of all, I think one of the most interesting things about the stimulus package is that it is really very popular. Popular with, Americans, and it's popular with business owners and so on and so forth. So the usual Republican line about something being too expensive may not gain as much traction, because one of the reasons why it's expensive is that the government put money directly in people's pockets. And we'll just have to see if, as we get farther from the stimulus package, as people are going back to work, as we're returning to normal business, that the arguments about the size of the deficit will gain traction. And of course, Biden has just now said that he would like to propose a tax increase on the wealthiest Americans. Mm-hmm. I can see that the detractors and the opponents of this tax increase are already working on their ads that would say something like, the biggest tax increase in history. People tend to overestimate the impact of these things on themselves, right? If there's a tax increase, even if the messaging is very clear that it only impacts people above a certain income level or who have certain kinds of wealth, a lot of folks will simply not believe that and think that they are being overtaxed and that their own taxes are going to go up, even if they are not in the affected group.
Right. And I think, to be specific, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think President Biden has promised if you make less than $400,000 a year, you will not be have your taxes raised. Dennis, your view on this?
Well, of course, this is the longstanding argument between Republicans and Democrats. Republicans are arguing here that, number one, there are a lot of goodies in this bill, a Christmas tree bill in which you hang a lot of different ornaments that aren't directly relevant to getting money into the hands of everyday people. The Democrats and of course Republicans are always concerned about inflation because that makes the money you hold worth less. Democrats argue that the inflation threat, according to most economists right now, is not very big at all. And Democrats make the argument to Republicans, you never think that putting more money in the hands of wealthy folks is going to hurt the economy by giving them a tax break. Mm-hmm. But you always believe that putting money in the hands of everyday folks is going to bust the budget and hurt the economy. This goes back in a way to arguments among economists during the Great Depression. And I think one of the economists, or it may have been President Franklin Roosevelt himself, who said, pay somebody, it may have been John Maynard Keynes, of course, the demand side economist, pay people to dig a hole and pay them to fill it up again. The key from their point of view is, if you put money in my hands, I can go spend it to buy dinner, even if it's takeout. That puts money into the hands of the employees there to pay their rent. That puts money in the hands of the apartment owners to pay their utilities and so forth. So that's the idea, is to re-stimulate an economy that's been under lockdown.
Mm-hmm. And this package, one of the largest economic stimulus measures in U.S. history, providing $1,400 direct payments to most Americans. I think some of those are landing even today, have been transferred to directly to bank accounts across the U.S. $350 billion in aid to state and local governments. There's the expansion of the child tax credit, also increased funding for COVID-19 vaccine distribution. If you've just joined us, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University, Karen Kodrowski of Iowa State University. Let's move to what's been making big news the last couple of days, the influx of migrants on the southern border. Yesterday, the Biden administration warned that the U.S. expected to make more apprehensions along the southwestern border this year than at any time in the past two decades. That prediction came from the Secretary of Homeland Security, Mayorkas. Joe Biden now being attacked for his handling of this surge at the border involving thousands of unaccompanied children, teenagers from the region. Joe Biden has pleaded for time and patience, blaming his predecessor for dismantling the immigration system. Let's hear a couple of the comments here. This one from our U.S. Senator Grassley on the floor of the U.S. Senate. He spoke about the crisis at the southern border. He argues that Democrats are doubling down on their position on the border and are drafting amnesty legislation that does not include border security.
And that crisis is people entering our country in violation of our laws. Since taking office, this administration has advanced policies that undermine immigration enforcement. These policies undermine efforts to secure our southern border, and they encourage illegal immigration into our country. President Biden has signaled that when it comes to immigration that violates our laws, the United States is open for business. Speaker Pelosi and House Democrats are doubling down on that position this very week. They're working to pass several mass amnesty bills that contain no provision related to securing the border.
All right, then in an interview last night with ABC's George Stephanopoulos, President Biden was asked if he was wrong not to anticipate the surge and that people are saying Biden promised to make things better, but they are getting worse.
Well, first of all, there was a surge the last 2 years in 19 and 20. There was a surge as well.
This one might be worse.
No, well, it could be, but here's the deal. First of all, the idea that Joe Biden said come, because I heard the other day that they're coming because they know I'm a nice guy and I won't do
what
Trump did.
They're saying this.
Yeah. Well, here's the deal. They're not. The adults are being sent back, number one. Number two, what do you do with an unaccompanied child that comes to the border? Do you repeat what Trump did? You take them from their mothers, to move them away, hold them in cells, et cetera? We're not doing that. So what we're doing is we have brought in HHS and also brought in FEMA to provide for enough safe facilities for them to get out of the control of the Border Patrol, which are not designed to hold people for long periods of time, particularly children, get them out of those facilities.
Okay. Dennis, let me start with you. What is your assessment of this latest surge and its political implications for the new president, who is, I don't believe, yet 60 days in office?
No. I mean, there's obviously both a political and a humanitarian dimension to this. The humanitarian dimension, of course, is that you have a lot of people surging north in the belief that they are severely economically disadvantaged in their home countries. They want a better life. That's what led most people to this continent for hundreds of years. Others believe they are physically in danger through persecution, jail, or actual under threat of death, in their home countries. At the same time, You know, President then Donald Trump said in 2016 and 2015 and on through his presidency that you have to have borders. If a country doesn't have borders, it's not a country. And that strikes a bell with a lot, certainly, of Trump supporters and perhaps some others, that most countries don't allow free, unrestricted access to their country past the borders. So the problem is, how do you deal with a situation like this in which you have people wanting to come in and other people concerned either politically, economically, culturally, that they don't want all these folks coming in? Of course, we had that with the Irish, certainly, in the 19th century. We had this with people from Eastern Europe in the early 20th century. So there's always been that concern. The difficulty is, of course, there's always someone on either or both sides willing to politicize all of this. And so the question is, can you address this as a problem as fairly as you can, or are you more interested in scoring political points?
Right. And which narrative will win in most Americans' minds? Karen Kidrowski, your thoughts on handling this problem. Of course, the Biden administration has said over and over, this isn't the time to come to those south of the border, not a message that's reaching the migrants by the numbers we see.
Yeah, the Biden administration is just, it has a horrifically difficult dilemma. And I think that, you know, everything that Dennis said is absolutely right. You know, we have a long suspicion of immigrants that are not sufficiently, quote unquote, and I'm using air quotes here, American, right? That they don't fit the community's vision of whatever that means. And that really, you know, taps into a longstanding sort of nativist tendency in the United States. And, you know, the Biden administration, if they send back, you know, the adults and the children, or have a child separation policy or anything like that, they're going to be criticized for it. If they, you know, have the people wait in Mexico, as the Trump administration did, those then that just shifts the burden to another country, but they're also staying in horrific conditions, and the administration will get criticized for that. And then allowing the children to stay in the country, even as unaccompanied minors, and trying to find safe places for them to be housed, there's going to be criticism for that, for allowing, quote unquote, illegal immigration. And in any case, I think what this says is that there is a pent-up demand for immigration from countries to our south, whether it's for economic reasons or whether it's for concern about escaping violence. And our policymakers need to, I think, have a serious discussion about what our immigration policy should look like. There are a lot of areas of this country, including many areas of the Midwest, that have declining populations. And there are worker shortages in many industries. And immigration is a way of dealing with those issues.
Right. And we have a time shortage. We've got to take a break. Karen Kidrowski, Dennis Goldford, back with more analysis from our two political scientists. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Back in a moment. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with us, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Karen Kidrowski of Iowa State University, our two political analysts, as we survey about a half a dozen news developments in our politics, having them comment and give us background so that we can better understand. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Before we move on, let's go to our caller. I can't go to the caller right now, but perhaps I will in the future, in the next few minutes. Let's talk about this, because whether it's immigration, border control, we have top priorities for Democrats. They've stated in Congress major investments in infrastructure, green jobs, expansion to voting rights, reforms to the democratic process, new protections for labor unions, universal background checks on gun sales. Now, we've seen in the U.S. House under Nancy Pelosi, many of those already have bills passed on them. None of those bills have much of a chance becoming law, though, as Republicans control 50 seats in the Senate, unless Democrats roll back or change the filibuster. And to roll back the filibuster, Democrats would need a simple majority, effectively meaning that the caucus would have to be unified in support of reform, a changing of this. So our news last night, the president endorsing a filibuster rule change, not elimination. Yesterday in an interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos, President Biden asked about the lack of Republican support in current and future legislation, if he was still reluctant to do away with the filibuster, and if he was going to have to choose between the filibuster or his agenda.
Yes, but here's the choice. I don't think you have to eliminate the filibuster. You have to do it what it used to be when I first got to the Senate and back in the old days when you used to be around there. And that is that a filibuster, you had to stand up and command the floor. And you had to keep talking alone. You couldn't call for, you know, no one could say, you know, quorum call. Once you stopped talking, you lost that, and someone could move in and say, I move the question of. So you got to work for the filibuster.
Okay, yesterday on the floor of the U.S. Senate, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell spoke about the importance of keeping the filibuster alive. He argued that eliminating the filibuster would not create a direct path for a liberal agenda to pass through the Senate.
Nobody serving in this chamber can even begin to imagine what a completely scorched earth Senate would look like. None of us have served 1 minute in a Senate that was completely drained of comedy and consent. Even the most basic aspects of our colleagues' agenda, the most mundane task of the Biden presidency, would actually be harder, not easier. Perhaps the majority would come after the other rules next. Perhaps Rule 22 would just be the first domino of many, until the Senate ceased to be distinct from the House in any respect. This chaos would not open up an express lane to liberal change. It would not open up an express lane for the Biden presidency to speed into the history books. The Senate would be more like a 100-car pileup.
Okay, Karen, let's start with you. What do you think about these two predictions for the future? Those Democrats in the Senate wanting to eliminate the filibuster, the president saying, well, let's go back to the way the filibuster used to be with a rule change. You have to get up and speak. And McConnell there saying it would result in a scorched earth.
Well, I think Republican leader McConnell is being a bit dire in his predictions. I think it's worthwhile to note a little bit about the history of the filibuster, because that has been the subject of a fair amount of incorrect information that I've seen floating around on social media and so forth. Okay, first of all, it was not created by the founders. It was not part of the original design of the Senate. The filibuster ended up being a part of the Senate rules quite by accident. So Aaron Burr, when he was vice president or a member of the Senate, suggested that the Senate simplify its rules and cited one particular rule, which was that it only took a majority vote to close debate, be eliminated because it was quote unquote duplicative. And so the Senate went along with that. And then because that rule was gone, later senators discovered that there was no effective way to stop debate. And ergo, the filibuster was born. The filibuster was not put in place by design in order to uphold white supremacy, though certainly members like Strom Thurmond did use the filibuster to oppose civil rights legislation. That's not its origin. And then around 1917, the Senate put in place Rule 22, which Senator McConnell referenced, which required a two-thirds vote to stop a filibuster. Or to end debate. And then that was amended in 1974 to drop it down to 60 votes. And President Biden is correct. For most of its history, the filibuster was an active event. Somebody had to stand up and hold the floor. Congressional scholars say actually the most famous filibuster is one that never happened, but it's the one in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, the Frank Capra movie.
Yes.
But yeah, but that was the model, right? Was that some one person got up and talked until they fell over. What it was replaced by then was a talking filibuster where it was more like a relay. So Senator A would talk until Senator A got tired and then yield to Senator B and they would keep going for a while. What has replaced that is something called the silent filibuster or a hold. And what this means is that all a senator has to do is communicate to the majority leader's office, which is does all the calendaring of floor debate, and to say, I don't like this bill. And if you bring this bill up for a vote, I will filibuster. And so I'm placing a hold on this bill until my objections are dealt with, you know, kind of behind the scenes. That has been what has proved to completely gum up the system is this use of the silent filibuster. And the Senate has been tinkering with filibuster or ways of getting around the filibuster already, such as the use of the reconciliation process, such as the fact that presidential cabinet nominees can no longer be filibustered. So the fact that they're now talking about amending or eliminating Rule 22 is not the revolutionary change that Senator McConnell is expecting, you know, or predicting. It would, however, mean that the minority would have fewer rights in the Senate, and the Senate would become more majoritarian as the House is.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, your view on this debate and the implications should the filibuster rules be changed?
Ditto.
Ditto on all that, yeah.
Aaron's explanation is very good. Yeah, I mean, the House is what I tell students. I say it's a lean, mean legislating machine. The majority runs everything in the House. The Senate was always considered to be more of a collegial body with more respect for the concerns of people in the minority on any particular issue or vote or even party. And, classic filibusters were like Strom Thurmond in the late 50s blocking civil rights legislation. If I remember correctly, at least from my history books, he read from the phone book. There was this privilege of unlimited debate in the Senate. It's part of Senate practice, Senate rules, as Karen said. It's not based upon the Constitution per se. That doesn't mean it's unconstitutional. It's just that it was a practice and then a rule that grew up over time. It's been used for good purposes and bad, depending upon your point of view. If you're going to lose a particular vote, the best way to avoid losing is making sure that that vote doesn't occur. And that's what the filibuster is used for. So it's worked out to the benefit of both parties at times and to the detriment of both parties at times. McConnell's threats, leaving those to the side, one of the things that you have to always be concerned about is be careful what you wish for, because it may come true.
Mm-hmm. And so, Dennis, do you think the Senate Democrats will eventually have enough support within their own ranks to make a rule change, such as perhaps the president suggested he is now behind?
Well, I don't know at this point. I mean, it's 50-50, as we know. Any tie is broken, whether it's 50-50 or 48-48, because four people aren't voting. Two on each side, it's broken by the vice president. Typically, in the first midterm following a presidential election, the president's party tends to lose seats, not always, but most of the time. Republicans certainly are hoping to become the majority again after the 22 elections. Democrats want to remain the majority. They're fearful they may not. So you may have some Democrats who are considering that possibility of ending up in the minority again. It was, though, the case that I mean, they made it easier to filibuster because you basically now just phone it in. And President Biden is saying, at least, let's go back to the old days. If you're going to filibuster, you have to have the stamina to stand up there and hold the floor as long as you can.
Right. You have to work for it, I think, were his words. Let's go to Tom. Tom is listening in Des Moines on this issue. Tom, you wanted to weigh in here quickly. We're coming up on the end of our program. Thanks for joining us.
Sometime caller. Just wanted to make sure that you're talking about the issue of 60 votes. So many times the 60-vote margin is required to introduce anything into the Senate, and that has been leading to the Senate being the place where bills go to die, and certainly when Mitch McConnell was the leader. So I just wanted to make sure that that was a part of your discussion, that eroding that 60-vote margin, the reconciliation that was done for the ARP, American Rescue Plan, can be applied to other bills as well. That seems to be the issue. Can we erode that a little bit so that we can get some of the issues like H.R. 1, immigration? Mm-hmm. These issues need more attention by the Senate. And if they don't have, if you have the 60-vote margin, the threshold, then that part of the filibuster is just sort of out of date.
Right. Tom, let's turn to Karen there. Karen knows so much. Answer Tom's concerns, Karen. Yeah.
Right. So Rule 22 is the rule that states the condition to end debate. And that is where the three-fifths margin or the 60-vote margin comes in. What I have heard over and over again, and when I see this on my student papers, it makes me want to pull my hair out, is that it takes 60 votes to pass a law in the Senate. That is not true. Legislation can be passed by a simple majority. Where the 60 votes comes in is when there is a filibuster. Now, how this tends to play out is because the silent filibuster or a hold is allowed, what this means is that somebody says, if you bring this bill up, I'm going to filibuster it. And then if they follow through on that threat, it takes 60 votes in order to be able to move on to the floor vote, which requires 51 votes for passage, right? So a simple majority. So that's where the confusion is. So if H.R. 1 and these other, you know, bills are not coming forward, it is because someone has placed a hold on them. And normally it's fairly easy to find this out. If you're working on the Hill, you know, there's a network and, you know, a lot of, you know, people who, you know, sort of, you know, talk about this through back channels so that you know who it is that has placed a hold on a piece of legislation. And usually that person has some reasons for it.
Okay.
Now, the reason why the stimulus bill was able to get through is that it went through on a reconciliation process.
Right.
And only bills that have budgetary implications can go through on reconciliation.
Okay. Let's move on to a last topic. We'll go to our Iowa legislature. With the crew we have today, namely Karen and Dennis, I wanted to get your thoughts on this because last night in the Iowa House, Republicans passed a bill that would ban school curriculum and government agency diversity training that, quote, promotes divisive concepts. Under the bill, ideas that would be off limits include, quoting again, the U.S. and the state of Iowa are fundamentally or systemically racist or sexist, and that an individual by virtue of their race or sex is inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive, whether consciously or unconsciously. Now, Democratic lawmakers oppose the bill. They say it'll prevent implicit bias training and deny the existence of white privilege and systemic racism. Let's hear a for and against from our legislature. This is during floor debate, Representative Henry Stone, a Republican from Forest City, and Representative Mary Wolf, a Democrat from Clinton, argued for their positions.
To say that we teach diversity by talking about that the United States and Iowa are fundamentally, which means at its root, and systemically racist or sexist. I don't believe that.
That is canceling reality, right? That is closing our eyes and trying to pretend that if we don't say implicit bias, it doesn't exist. Or if we don't say systemic racism, we can pretend we don't have that.
Okay, Dennis, let me start with you. We have about 5 minutes total. What do you think about this Republican proposal that is advancing in the Iowa State House, a pushback against diversity training?
Well, you know, I don't normally preface a comment with this, but I, you know, I have to say I have a vested interest as a professor, as an academic. And, you know, the general principle is the cure for incorrect or bad speech is more speech. And so the thought that there are certain things that you're not allowed to teach, to debate, to talk about, is something I find professionally and personally very, very dangerous. It's like saying, gee, we may lose this ball game, so we're going to make sure we're not allowed to play this ball game, as opposed to actually playing the game and let the best person or the better side win. Mm-hmm. So, again, I understand the sensitivity in terms of being critical of various aspects of our history. I'm not sure that anybody wants to say that we are a perfect country. I mean, listen to people on all sides criticize various aspects of our history. But this sounds like an attempt to ban the criticism as opposed to engaging in the criticism and dealing with the counterarguments and trying to find your way to the truth of the matter.
Right. And a bit of nuance here to emphasize, and I know you were recognizing that too in your comments, Dennis, but Republican lawmakers say they want diversity trainings to continue, but not by marking each person as either oppressor or the oppressed in a sexist or racist way. Karen, weigh in here as a director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics.
Oh, boy, this could get me into trouble. Let me just say that I think it's deeply ironic that the state legislature has expressed enormous concern about the freedom of speech of conservative students on the Regents University campuses. And I frankly think that the incidents that have come to the fore, they're making an excellent point. I think all of those played out badly and did, in fact, intimidate conservative students or silence their views. But here, the state legislature has now silenced the views of people who would be conducting this type of diversity training. So what does this mean? The state legislature only believes that students should have freedom of speech, but not the employees who are teaching them, that conservative people can have freedom of speech, but not people that they disagree with. And I really think that the entire bill is on very shaky constitutional grounds.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard, Karen, if anything like this has helped as gotten a foothold as a proposal in another state. Are we alone?
I have not heard of anything like this at all, though there are other states that are considering replicating essentially the guidance that came out of the Trump administration that was very similar about what diversity training could look like. And that was overturned by the Biden administration. So now many states are looking at implementing it at the state level, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head how many.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left to you, Dennis, perhaps in the last word on this or something else that you feel needed to be in our political discussion this hour that didn't.
Oh, my, so many different things.
Yeah.
But
well,
I think, no, again, I think that with regard to this particular matter, you know, we're all sensitive to being criticized with regard to the things that matter most to us. But the whole point is that if you rule certain things out of bounds or something that you can't talk about,
then you've lost your ability to defend your point of view and make your point of view, in addition to criticizing another point of view. And that's Karen very well pointed out the irony of people who want to claim in the name of free speech to limit or abolish some free speech.
Right, and I think the point here too, isn't it, Karen, that, you know, racist can be a quality. I can make an impolite, in the way I can make an impolite remark, I can make a racist remark. I can stop being impolite, stop being rude, and I can stop being racist. It's an attribute, right? It's not something that a person is forevermore.
I think that's one way of understanding it. And of course, systemic racism as a concept would say that racism isn't necessarily about individual actions. It's about laws and social practices and systematic forms of discrimination that are what is problematic, and that we have, you know, systems of education and healthcare and criminal justice that have habitually benefited people who are white.
Okay, we have to go.
Of people of color.
Karen Kodrowski, Dennis Goldford, we have to go. It's been a pleasure being with you. Thank you so much.
You bet.
All right. Thank you.